following podcast has adult themes and some strong language.
On 23rd of August 1973, a Swedish career criminal, Jan Erik Olsson, entered a Stockholm bank with the intention to rob it. Police arrived quickly on the scene, and after a brief firefight, four bank workers were taken hostage. Olsson insisted as part of the negotiations with the police that his friend Clark Olofsson be let into the bank with him. The police acquiesced and began negotiations with the pair. After six long days of negotiations, which even included a phone call from the Prime Minister, the siege was over and the hostages were freed. But it was clear something odd had happened. The hostages had formed a positive relationship with their captors. One hostage had spoken to the Prime Minister to state that the police were handling the situations badly and both Olsson and Olofsson should be let go. Olofsson would later become close friends with one of the hostages. Criminologist and psychiatrist Nils Bjurå was later to create a phrase as a way of an explanation. Stockholm syndrome. Being put in a situation of abject fear but responding to small acts of kindness, like being offered a drink. Like many labels, though, it has its critics. So does it exist? My mother would like to think so. My name is Jessica J. Garner, and this is my life. Hello and welcome to episode 7, and this week we're talking about family. When I was growing up, there was a lot of talk of the average family, which was a man and a woman with 2.4 children. This was drummed into us at school, and where we dared ask what on earth 0.4 of a child was, we were told not to be so stupid, it was just a statistical average. Of course, I studied maths, and I know for a fact that when the object cannot be quantified, you must round up and down using 0.5 as your baseline. That would mean the average family has two children. Fuck the trendy advertisers. We were told so many times in school that this was going to happen to us, the girls especially. Go and get yourself a nice typing job because all you're going to amount to is to be a little baby factory for the first male that takes an interest in you. I'm not suggesting that our working class state school was trying to brainwash us into living within the patriarchy. I'm telling you, that's exactly what they were doing. By the time I was 15, there were pupils that had already come out as gay or bisexual. We knew, and the teachers knew, but it was never acknowledged. We were being fed scary ads after kids' TV that AIDS was just the tip of the iceberg, and don't die of ignorance like Sun readers do. That last bit was a popular car sticker at the time. Again, big things like that wasn't discussed. Girls, as long as you could cook and sew, you'll be okay. And boys, go and be a mechanic or a plumber. We didn't stand a chance, really. The latest statistics on marriage in UK government was 2017. They meant it to be updated last year. On the ONS site, it states that marriage rates for opposite-sex couples are now at the lowest rate on record. This continues a gradual, long-term decline seen since the early 1970s, with numbers falling by a third over the past 40 years. In 2017, there were 6,932 marriages of same-sex couples, of which 56% were between female couples. A further 1,072 couples converted their existing civil partnership into a marriage. This goes to show from when I was at school, in the last 10 years, marriage and how marriage is thought of is finally changing. About time. Nothing to do with families, but somebody reminded me of my least favourite quote. If I can do it, anyone can. Isn't that one of the most insidious statements ever to be issued? It makes no allowance for anyone's circumstances. Maybe you've been able to achieve whatever it is because you're a complete narcissist who can block everyone else out. I am not belittling anyone's achievements. If anyone's doing that, they are. I'm just stating that it makes no allowances for another person's situation, what they've been through, what they are currently going through. But still, people look on the surface. They see perfect marriages and perfect jobs and perfect lives. Not that everyone is miserable, far from it. It's just maybe when someone's banging on about how perfect their life is, maybe they're hoping it can be like that. Not that it is like that. I know I sound like those insidious memes on social media about being nice to everyone because everyone is fighting their own battles. But it's true. Just be pleasant. Polite to all unless they give you a reason not to. Then just try being even more pleasant to annoy them. So what have we learned? Be nice to everyone, and insidious is a great word. Use it in a sentence or two today. If I can do it, anyone can. Here's a quote by Michael J. Fox that I can only agree with as long as we're not talking about family in a conventional sense. Family is not an important thing, it's everything. I'm taking for what I hope will be a little break from the podcast for a while. So I had to go back to the original The Office for what we can learn from TV, and it's a little tribute. David Brent is one of the greatest creations in comic history. I can't argue the greatest, there have been some on equal footing. There's something just so beautiful and heartbreaking about him. That said, could you stand to have him around you? That's the beauty of him though. He's real. You've met him. You can't quite befriend him, but you just can't hate him. In fact, you would be a hard person to wish him anything but well. He also said, life is just a series of peaks and troughs, and you don't know whether you're in a trough until you're climbing out, or on a peak until you're coming down. And that's it, you know. You never know what's around the corner. It's all good. It's great, isn't it? A modern-day Shakespeare, one of the most truthful and uncynical quotes about life. Okay, I know, but I am choosing to ignore the line about Dolly Parton and a big pair of tits. I've been thinking about this little adventure. Now I'm nearing the end of the first part of it, hopefully. Maybe that's it, though. It's been tough. The stuff I would have done differently, like not write, read, record, edit, do post-production and publish it all myself. Next time I'm winning the lottery and having Reese Witherspoon read it, because I bet she would do an awesome Cardiff accent. Also sound engineered. You are amazing. I want to work with you. I listen to podcasts quite a bit. A lot of the time I use it as a bedtime story. I tend to listen to indie podcasts because I don't want to skip forward through ads. Also, thanks to the timer function, I can fall asleep without worrying about running down my phone battery. It's only just now, yeah, it took a while, that I realise you might listen to this as you're falling asleep. I'm not bothered by this and I'm just grateful you're listening. I don't tend to dream about what I'm listening to, so I hope you don't either. Nightmares are never good. I tell you what else can happen to me. I will be listening, then from nowhere music will start and it won't make sense. I will still convince myself I have not fallen asleep, but I clearly have. You know where this is going. Come on, let's play a trick on those swines who've fallen asleep while I've been pouring my guts out here. Ready? Cue music. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was when I won my first Nobel Peace Prize for Literature. Okay, family. I have been dreading doing this, but it's also part of the jigsaw. My jigsaw, anyway. The reason why my friends wrongly don't want to lean on me too hard. Who I am. Why I am. The Jessica Garner origin story. 3 glasses of wine and here I am. I was born in Cardiff in the 1970s to parents Emma Devlin and David Garner. They had this amazing love story. Amazing because it was beautiful and tragic. The literary dream. Emma, my mother, was born and raised in Enniskerry, which is near Dublin. Her mother, Rosina, brought her up single-handed because her father, Frank, ran away when she was 2. She doesn't remember him. Probably for the best. Lucina was strict, but it sounded like she was needy rather than on a power trip. Emma was her only daughter, and she'd already lost her husband. Lucina just doted on her daughter, but it felt like suffocation for Emma. Dad's first boy's holiday was 1968, and they went to the party city of Dublin. Emma just started working and persuaded her mother that a work night out was obligatory. She wanted to keep a job. Emma and David met in Temple Bar. It was love and first sight, according to my mum. To be fair, they did make a beautiful couple. I've seen the pictures. They kept in touch as much as you could in 1968, which was letters and postcards, and very quick phone calls. In 1969, Mum decided that she couldn't be apart any longer and she moved to Cardiff to be with Dad. Of course, that wasn't just it. It was 1969. Grandmother Rosina forbade her to go, said it would kill her if she went. It didn't. Took her 2 more years to die. When Mum arrived in Cardiff, she had to live in a tiny flat because couples didn't live together then. They had to save to get married and buy their first home. Save they did, and in 1972, they had enough to get married and move into their first home. They didn't have much extended family, both only childs. Dad's mum Sarah and father Ron were older when he was born. They didn't even think they could have children, but in their early 40s, along came Dad, and they were happy. I was very much planned and loved. I mean, I don't know, but I was told. I felt it, though. I felt loved and secure. I was told I was a happy child, and I think I was. I've seen the pictures. One of my earliest memories is Mum and Dad telling me I was going to have a little brother or sister. I think, anyway. I may have imagined it. I would have been 2 at the time, so who knows. I was excited, though. I may have had a fake memory of that, too, but I was told I was excited. I used to talk to Mum's belly and tell the unborn child how we were going to play together. When Owen was born, I apparently adored him. I mean, I know I did, but again, I was 2. We were a normal, average family. Mum and Dad, Jessica and Owen. Us against the world, and we were happy. There were memories I have that were definitely true. Seeing the Star Wars films in a cinema when they came out. The street party when Charles and Diana married. My birthday parties, Owen's birthday parties, when we were allowed red pop, which we always managed to spill. The days spent in zoos, in fairgrounds, in parks. Our holidays in Devon, where we used to spend all day on the beach because the sun always shone. Okay, maybe the long, hot summers were probably made up. Maybe we were lucky, or maybe I'm just remembering moments. It's a stereotype, I know, but we were poor and happy. Of course, that's not to say we didn't have our moments. We did. Mum and Dad were passionate with each other, which obviously led to some amazing rows. They made up, though, and always made sure Owen and I were not affected. We always had an abundance of love, hugs and kisses and had no real idea of what was coming and how it would change. I was 9. We had just finished swimming and Owen was being annoying. We both wanted to sit behind Dad in the car, I think because there was more leg room, or maybe we just preferred him more. I felt, as the oldest, I should have first pick. Dad flipped the coin and I lost. We got in the car and I told Owen that I hated him and I would never speak to him again. That's the last thing I remember that day. I woke up a couple of days later in the hospital. Nana Garner was stood over me. I was in so much pain, but I still remember that sickly, horrible feeling of complete dread. She was stroking my hair, telling me everything was all right, but she looked so terrible I knew it wasn't. A nurse came in and gave me something for the pain and it didn't help. Then Nan told me what happened. How a couple of teenagers stole a car and driven through a red light to escape police. How we happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and they drove into the side of our car. The side my father and my brother had been sat in. The side completely smashed in. The side where no one had survived. I asked for Mum, but she was in a pretty bad way herself. Owen and Dad had taken the impact, which is believed to have killed them immediately. Dad was 35 and Owen was 7. Mum spent months in the hospital, but eventually made a full recovery. And I stayed with Nan and eventually went home with Mum. But we were changed. I was no longer a happy child. I spent hours at a time crying and wouldn't let anyone comfort me. Mum didn't know how to deal with me and I didn't know how to deal with her. We were strangers. She had lost the love of her life and her child, and I'd lost my amazing dad and my brother, who is my best friend. I managed to go longer periods without crying and kind of got on with things. Worked hard at school, becoming the model pupil, and I read vivaciously anything to escape my life. Mum was distant, but she gradually began to look like her old self. She started socialising and she met Sean Jones. It was a gradual thing at first, but eventually he moved in. We didn't get on. He is a complete narcissist. He resented me, wanting Mum to himself. She doted on him because he gave her something else to think about, I think. I never wanted to win him over. I don't like him then, don't like him now, and I will never like him. They got married though in 1989. I kept myself to myself because I had nowhere else to go. But I went to university in 1992 and moved out completely. I shared a student house, and for the first time in such a long time, I was happy. Mum claimed she was happy too and wanted a fresh start. In actual fact, it was the perfect time Sean can claim them all to himself. So he moved halfway across the world in 1994. I hadn't been to Australia and she hasn't been back. We exchanged letters and now emails maybe once a month. So that's it really. Why friends are family. Why I have to keep on living for Owen because but for a flip of a coin, he would have to keep living for me. Also, because of the events of that day, I was left with a health condition over 25 years later has kept me inside for over a year. And I managed to get through it without crying. Hey, me. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I don't hate my mother. Plenty of other people in my life to do that for me. I just remind her of another life. A life when she was happy. Honestly, sometimes I'm jealous. I've never had what they had, and maybe you can only have it when it's incredibly short. Who knows? Maybe you're not destined for it. Maybe most of us aren't. Here's a quote I can 100% agree with from the goddess that is Jennifer Aniston. Where would we be without friends? The people to pick you up when you need lifting. We come from homes far from perfect, so you end up almost a parent and sibling to your friends, your chosen family. Now would be a good time to thank my friends for their role in my life, and I do. But I hope to fuck they never hear this. If you know them, just keep it between us. Just wanted to give you a little catch up. I had my second jab over 3 weeks ago and Ben has just received a negative test today, so he's coming around later. I mean this quite literally. Thank fuck for that. Ems is doing okay. She has a lot of work to do, but at least she's finally being honest with me. I called Izzy after the conversation with Ems and she had some news. Her sister has given birth to a baby boy called Damien. I didn't even know she was pregnant. Something else being kept from me because Izzy was dealing with it. It's just something else has been going on in the past year then. All that talk about separated together. We've all just been separated. And me? I am just fine. Finally, my last quote is from the fictional character, Gregory House, from the show House, who said, "Everybody lies." A huge thank you to everyone who's listened and said nice things. It means more than you know. It just leaves me to say, please come back. I'm not needy or anything, but please. Also, a lot of this stuff is from the internet, and did you know the internet can lie? If you want to know more about me, go to Insta, excuse the Jess, and maybe we'll do this again soon.
Excuse the Jess was written and performed by Jackie J. Sarah. It is a deliciously bright production. If you enjoyed this, please click follow and give us a 5-star review or donate via Buy Me a Coffee. All details, including full credits, can be found on the website excusethejest.com. Thanks for listening.